The Unscrupulous Suitors. How Kaiser Steel arrived at this sorry state is an American tragedy. Forbes. While local 2869 was fruitlessly searching for friends in high places, Kaiser Steel was like Ulysses' wife Penelope, haplessly pursued by 100 unscrupulous suitors. Despite the reluctance of other steelmakers to assimilate Fontana to their operations, there was no shortage of corporate predators eager to strip-mine the company's financial reserves. Following the sale of the offshore mineral properties, the company was temporarily awash in liquidity. By one estimate, almost $500 million. Many Wall Street analysts believed that the plant was undervalued. With shrewd management, they guessed that the modernized core could be reconfigured as a profitable mini-mill, fabricating imported slabs or local scrap. While the new CEO, the sixth in 7 years, Stephen Gerard, feuded with the Kaiser family over the terms of sale, desperate unionists and stockholders looked toward San Francisco investor Stanley Hiller, who was rumored to represent billionaire speculators Daniel Ludwig and Gaith Faraone. Hiller's offer of $52 per share appeased the Kaiser family, but Gerard, trying to retain control over a cash hoard still estimated at $430 million, broke off negotiations. The Kaisers, backed by the union, which believed it could interest the Hiller Group in its ESOP concept, rallied other large stockholders to override Gerard. By March 1982, however, when Gerard resumed talks with Hiller, the write-down costs of phased-out steel facilities, originally estimated at $150 million, were admitted to be nearly $530 million, including $112 million in employee termination costs. The contingent liabilities and health and benefits for the laid-off workforce seemed especially to overawe the Hiller Group, who, to the consternation of unionists and stockholders, abruptly retreated from the field on the 11th of March. The company promptly moved to claim tax write-offs by auctioning its primary steelmaking equipment for scrap, a final blow that killed any hope of an ESOP-based resurrection. In late October 1983, the last heat of Eagle Mountain iron ore was smelted into steel. For another month, a skeleton crew of 800, out of a workforce that once numbered 9,000, cold-rolled the remaining slabs into coils, sheets, and plate. At 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 31st of December, Kaiser Steel Fontana died. While thousands of Kaiser workers and their families mourned the sinking of California's industrial flagship, sharks in gray flannel suits circled around the undervalued assets of Kaiser Steel, no longer hemorrhaging $12 million per month in operating deficits. The first to strike was corporate raider Irwin Jacobs of Minneapolis, known in the trade as Irv the Liquidator, who had become the leading shareholder after the withdrawal of Hiller. Scared that he would simply gut the company, Kaiser Steel management swung behind the rival bid of Oklahoma investor J.A. Freights. Then, as Forbes later reported, Monty Ryle suddenly appeared, uninvited and unknown, swaggering like a corporate Butch Cassidy and brandishing the high-powered law firm of Wachtel, Lipton, Rosen & Katz. Posing as a coal baron from Colorado, though his holdings had never actually produced a ton of coal, Ryle dealt himself into the Kaiser Steel takeover game by boasting that he could profitably restructure the company around its billion tons of high-grade coal reserves in Utah and New Mexico. What Jacobs and Freights didn't realize or bother to find out was that Ryle was simply bluffing. While laying siege to Kaiser's half-billion-dollar equity, Ryle's Perma Group was itself less liquid than some of the Fontana bars in which the ex-steelworkers groused. According to Forbes, the Perma Group couldn't even pay its copying bills. A local copy shop was pursuing the company to collect a past due $1,200, which Perma paid in 12 monthly installments. No matter. An impressed and incredibly gullible Freights admitted Ryle, it rhymes with smile, as a 50-50 partner. In February 1984, they outbid Jacobs to take control of Kaiser Steel, offering $162 million in cash and $218 million in preferred stock. The most viable sections of the Fontana plant were immediately sold off for $110 million, exactly the amount that Kaiser had borrowed from the RFC in 1942, to a remarkable consortium that included a Long Beach businessman, Japan's giant Kawasaki Steel, and Brazil's Companhia Valério Dos Limited. In a mind-bending demonstration of how the new globalized economy works, California Steel Industries, as the consortium calls itself, employs a de-unionized remnant of the Kaiser workforce under Japanese and British supervision to roll and fabricate steel slabs imported from Brazil to compete in the local market against Korean imports. Derelict Eagle Mountain, whose iron ores are 5,000 miles closer to Fontana than Brazil's, has meanwhile been proposed as a giant dump for the non-degradable solid waste being produced by the burgeoning suburbia of the Inland Empire. While Fontanans were trying to absorb these strange economic dialectics, Ryle, the guy who couldn't pay his Xerox bill 10 months before, was wrestling control of the company from Freights and transferring its headquarters to Colorado. His method for financing the takeover was ingenious. He sold the Kaiser Steel, at incredibly inflated prices, additional coal reserves which he owned and which it scarcely needed. The impact of the two back-to-back leveraged buyouts was little short of devastating. The original $500 million cash hoard was reduced to $500,000 as the raiders ran away with their spoils. Moreover, the company was hopelessly saddled with new and utterly unnecessary debt. As the rest of the business press was celebrating the contribution of corporate raiders to making the economy leaner and greener, two Forbes journalists saw a different moral in the story of Freights and Ryle looting Kaiser Steel without spending a penny of their own money. Freights staged a classic no-money-down 1980s takeover. Kaiser Steel changed hands for $380 million. Where did the money come from? Not from the pockets of the people doing the takeover. The Freights Group used $100 million borrowed from Citibank and $62 million of Kaiser's own cash to pay $22 a share to Kaiser's stockholders and gave them $30 face value of preferred stock for the rest of the price. Thus, for $162 million that wasn't his and $218 million of paper in the form of Kaiser's Steel preferred, Freights took over the company. Naturally, Freights took millions of dollars in fees and expenses, so his net cash investment was less than nothing. To buy out Freights, Ryle traded illiquid assets to Kaiser for land and cash. Kaiser shelled out $78 million for the same PERMA assets Freights valued 18 months earlier at only $65 million. What's more, because the SPS coal contract was valued at only $12.2 million this time around, the value of Ryle's coal properties must have risen to $65.8 million, a 65% increase. When the dust settled, Freights had $20 million of cash, a $5 million near-cash receivable, and $15 million of Kaiser land. Ryle hasn't stinted himself, however. He took $2.4 million in salary last year. Ryle's swashbuckling depredations finally provoked a backlash from Kaiser Steel's preferred stockholders, who allied themselves with Bruce Hendry, the famous scrap dealer in distressed companies. He had previously picked over the remains of Erie Lackawanna and Wicks. Forcing Ryle aside as CEO in 1987, Hendry proposed to rescue the stockholders' equity at the expense of the ex-Kaiser workforce. Borrowing a leaf from Frank Lorenzo, Hendry plunged Kaiser Steel into a Chapter 11 proceeding in order to liquidate worker entitlements. During the shutdown in 1983, workers had taken some solace in the assurance that cash-rich Kaiser, unlike some bankrupted Eastern steelmakers, would always be able to honor its obligations. Now, 4 years later, 6,000 outraged former employees watched as Hendry canceled their medical coverage and pension supplements, while transferring part of the burden of their pension funding to the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. In order to deflect worker anger, he also initiated lawsuits to recover the $325 million in Kaiser reserves, allegedly stolen by Freights and Ryle through their buyouts. At the moment of writing, 3 years further on, most of the benefits remain unrecovered. The various lawsuits have disappeared in a judicial logjam, and thousands of ex-steelworkers and their families have endured further, unexpected hardships. The Mirage of Redevelopment. Nothing is as nice as developing Fontana. Current official slogan. Fontana, headed for economic catastrophe. Headline, 1987. Even as the Reagan boom was taking off in 1983, steel towns were still dying across the country, from Geneva, Utah to Lackawanna, New York, Fairfield, Alabama to Youngstown, Ohio. Aliquippa, from which so many Fontanans had emigrated in the 1940s and 1950s, was amongst the hardest hit. The shutdown of the immense 7-mile-long Jones and Laughlin, LTV, complex, and the layoff of 20,000 workers was the equivalent of a nuclear disaster. A third of the population fled. Of those left behind, more than half were still jobless 4 years after the closure. The Salvation Army became the town's leading employer. A 1986 study of 300 Aliquippa families revealed that 59% had difficulty feeding themselves, 49% were behind in their utility bills, and 61% could not afford to see a doctor. Driving through the valley on Thanksgiving Day 1988, on the way to lay a wreath at the Union Martyrs Monument in Homestead, I found little improvement or new hope. For miles along the Ohio River, the sides of the great mill had been stripped away by demolition crews, exposing the rusting entrails of pipework and machinery. Downtown Aliquippa, tightly wedged in its abrupt valley, was boarded up and as empty as any western ghost town. At the old main gate, through which 10,000 Aliquippans had once daily streamed to work, a forlorn lean-to and some fading picket signs announced Fort Justice, the site of a feudal 2-year vigil by local unionists to save the plant from demolition. By any standard, Fontana should have suffered the same fate as Aliquippa. Studies in the early and late 1970s confirmed that almost half of the town worked for Kaiser, and nearly three-quarters drew paychecks dependent upon the mill. Yet, when the final shutdown came in December 1983, Fontana was a boom, not a ghost town. Side by side with the defeated mill town, a new community of middle-class commuters was rapidly taking shape. In the last years of the plant's life, the population began to explode, doubling from 35,000 to 70,000 between 1980 and 1987, with predictions of 100,000 to 150,000 by the year 2000. In an interview with the Times, as the last slabs were being rolled out at Kaiser, Fontana's Mayor Simon exulted about the city's newfound prosperity as the housing frontier of Southern California. Nobody expected what's been happening here. When Kaiser closed, everybody thought the town was going to go kaput, but that hasn't happened. The recycling of Fontana had begun in the mid-1970s, after a clique of local landowners and city officials, led by city manager Jack Rattell, recognized that residential redevelopment was a lucrative alternative to continued dependence upon the waning fortunes of Kaiser Steel and its blue-collar workforce. Unlike Aliquippa, they had the dual advantages of being the periphery of a booming regional economy and having access to an extraordinary tool of community restructuring, California's redevelopment law. Created by a liberal legislature in the late 1940s to allow cities to build public housing in blighted areas, the law had become totally perverted by the 1970s. Not only was it being employed for massive poor removal in downtown San Francisco and Los Angeles, but blight was now so generously interpreted that wealthy cities and industrial enclaves from Palm Springs to City of Industry were using the law to build luxury department stores, convention centers, and championship golf courses with tax increments withheld from general fund uses. Fontana's particular riff on these redevelopment strategies was its creation of an open, some would say golden, door for developers. Rattell and the other city fathers fretted about their ability to compete with Rancho Cucamonga to the west, a greenfield city concocted out of several thinly populated agricultural townships. In order to eventually become like Orange County, they started out by acting like Puerto Rico. To compensate for gritty Fontana's image problem, and to give it a comparative advantage in the Inland Empire's land rush, they bent redevelopment law to offer creative financing for large-scale developers. Tax increment and tax-exempt bonds, waiver of city fees, massive tax rebates, and, unique to Fontana, direct equity participation by the redevelopment agency. Application and inspection processes were drastically streamlined to accelerate groundbreaking in the city that aspired to become the developer's best friend. Fontana's pioneer redevelopment project was an expensive, many would say unnecessary, facelift of Sierra Avenue, begun in 1975. David Weiner, whom the local paper likes to call the Dean of Fontana Developers, was given tax-exempt financing and sales tax rebates to construct four new shopping complexes. A little later, the Fontana Redevelopment Agency, FRA, began to uproot vineyards south of Interstate 10 to build the Southwest Industrial Park. But the big Orange County and West LA-based developers, already heavily involved in Ontario and Rancho Cucamonga, refused to consider Fontana until it was clear that Kaiser Steel was doomed and that the Milltown onus could be removed. Fontana's first mega project, initiated in 1981, was the Village of Southridge, located in the Harupa Hills redevelopment area south of I-10 and projected for a build-out of 9,000 homes by the year 2000. Creative Communities, the Huntington Beach-based developers of Southridge, seduced Fontana's civic leaders by giving them a tour of Irvine, the famous master-planned city in southern Orange County. They convinced the star-struck Fontanans that a simulacrum of Irvine could be developed in Fontana's own south end, if the city were willing to provide adequate infrastructure and financing. As Mayor Simon later recalled, the city fathers wanted the project so bad that they could taste it. Accordingly, with visions of Fontana as Irvine dancing before their eyes, they signed a far-reaching agreement with Creative Communities that pledged the FRA to reimburse most of the infrastructural costs normally borne by developers. In 1982, 1 year after the groundbreaking in Southridge, Fontana annexed a huge triangle of boulder-strewn fields north of the city, abutting Interstate 15, then under construction. The completion of I-15 through western San Bernardino and Riverside and northern San Diego counties has created one of the nation's most dynamic growth corridors. One of the corridor's boomtowns is Ranch, California, a 100,000-acre project originated by Kaiser Development Company in Temecula. 300,000 new residents are expected in western San Bernardino County alone. Fontana, sitting at the strategic intersection of I-15 and I-10, the San Bernardino Freeway, has superb linkages to this rapidly expanding commuter shed. The North Fontana project area, which incorporates the old Fontana ghetto, an area of ironically exploding land values, is the largest redevelopment project in California, 14 square miles, encompassing a series of prospective master-planned communities. Largest is the upscale Village of Heritage, directly competitive with Rancho Cucamonga's Terra Vista and Victoria, which is being developed by BD Partners of West Los Angeles, Richard Barkley and Joseph DeLorio, with heavy equity participation from FRA. Heritage will provide 4,000 of the 18,000 new homes that the FRA wants to add in North Fontana over the next generation. By the time the demolition crews had got around to dismantling Big Bess, Fontana's leaders had managed to put 20,000 new homes in the $60,000 and up range on the drawing boards in Southridge and North Fontana. Within 4 years of Kaiser Steel's closure, raw land prices in Fontana had doubled. This remarkable achievement garnered national accolades and much talk of a paradigmatic Fontana miracle. The Los Angeles Times, for example, downplayed the impact of the Kaiser shutdown and resulting 15% local unemployment, which it misreported as 9%, in order to emphasize the city's bright future under its redevelopment strategy. Journalists uncritically reproduced city officials' claims that Fontana would soon be wealthy from its soaring tax bases and profits on its equity position in different developments. Just as Kaiser Industrial Relations had once been studied as a textbook model, now Fontana's resilience was presented as laboratory confirmation of the Reagan administration's claim that deindustrialization was only a temporary and marginal cost in the transition to post-industrial prosperity based on services, finance, and real estate. The first symptom that all was really not so well in Fontana Redux was the sharp increase in white supremacist agitation and racial violence after the layoffs at the mill. During the course of 1983, the local Ku Klux Klan, about 24 strong, crawled out from under their rock and began distributing leaflets in the high schools, holding public rallies, and even offering to assist the Fontana police. The Klan revival seems to have exercised a certain charisma upon a periphery of skinhead youth. In a savage October 1984 attack, a 20-year-old black man, Cezon Davis, was left paralyzed from the chest down after being beaten by three skinheads on Sierra Avenue, Fontana's main street. The black community was further outraged, shades of O'Day short, when the San Bernardino County District Attorney refused to prosecute the white youth, one of whose mothers was the dispatcher for the Fontana police. The reaction of Fontana Development Director Neil Stone to this local precursor of Howard Beach was to moan, "Image has been our main problem." Worse problems lay soon ahead. By Christmas 1986, the Fontana bubble had burst. City Finance Director Edwin Lukemeyer resigned in face of charges that he had embezzled public funds and sold off city-owned vehicles to his friends and relatives. Within 6 months, the stream of resignations and indictments prompted one paper to claim that police detectives and auditors are almost as common a sight in City Hall as file clerks. Amongst the new casualties, a list that included the city treasurer, the motor pool director, the redevelopment director, and the development director, was city manager and ex officio FRA chief Jack Rattell, the chief architect of the third Fontana. The city council forced Rattell to resign after published reports of gratuities from leading developers made his position untenable. The demoralization in Fontana City Hall was turned into panic in August 1987 by the release of an independent audit of the city by the regional office of Arthur Young. The Young report was devastating. The FRA was in a chaotic state of disarray, and the city was on the edge of bankruptcy. The Young analysts discovered that the FRA had pawned Fontana's future in order to seduce developers. With 60% of its tax base located in redevelopment areas and obligated as payments or rebates to developers, the city could not afford to meet the needs of its expanding population. No tax revenue was left over to pay for the additional load that the new suburban population placed on its schools or public services. Southridge alone, which Rattell had always portrayed as a municipal gold mine, threatened to drive the city into bankruptcy, as the FRA faced $10,000 per day in new interest charges accumulating on the unreimbursed principal which it owed creative communities. Official estimates of the total tax revenue that will be absorbed in debt service to Southridge run as high as $750 million by 2026, when the agreement expires. It is unlikely that the principal will ever be repaid. Like a miniature Mexico or Bolivia, Fontana is a debtor nation held in thrall to its Orange County and West LA creditor developers. With its suburban property tax streams diverted to debt service, the city has had both to impose austerity in the form of overcrowded schools and degraded services, and, as in Southridge, special fee assessments on unhappy new arrivals. The alternative of raising additional city income from existing commerce is excluded by the FRA's profligate rebates of sales taxes and municipal fees to the owners of the new shopping centers. The release of the Young report, which also included sensationalist details of financial mismanagement and the destruction of records in City Hall, emboldened local journalists to muckrake through the FRA's records, untangling the circumstances of the agency's incredible profligacy. Mark Gucklick of the Herald News eventually exposed in detail how various redevelopment schemes had pauperized the city. The older mom-and-dad businesses along Sierra Avenue, for instance, were starved of redevelopment funds by FRA policies that favored chain-store Kmartization. Thus, the FRA, in a typical example, gave tax-exempt financing and a $750,000 tax rebate to induce National Lumber to move into one of David Weiner's new shopping centers, itself financed by tax givebacks. The net result for the city was a large tax deficit and the closure of Ole's Hardware, an old-time Fontana institution. Likewise, in the case of Southridge, Glick revealed how city manager Rattel and redevelopment lawyer Timothy Sabo, accused in the Young report of raking off excessive fees, overrode the strong objections of the city attorney to provide Creative Communities, later 1090 Limited, with whatever they demanded, hiked up interest rates on FRA's obligation, forgiveness for their failure to build schools on time per contract, and so on. Moreover, the developers were repeatedly allowed to modify the community's specific plan, successively reducing the quality of housing and local amenities. The developers, in turn, pampered officials like Planning Chief Neil Stone with finder's fees, gratuities, and the use of a lakeside resort, while Southridge, which Mayor Simon liked to call the Beverly Hills of Fontana, evolved into misery. One planner who worked there has described it as rabbit hutches with two-car garages, without adequate schools or public services. Not surprisingly, the Young report and the Gutglick revelations fueled a revolt by embittered Southridge residents who demanded a moratorium on further growth, the recall of the council majority, and a system of district elections. Given the enormity of Fontana's suddenly exposed problems, the venality of its officials, its Andean-sized debt and the lean on its tax base until the next millennium, its underfunding of essential services, a growing mismatch between housing and jobs, and so on, the voter revolt was strangely muffled. Closure of Kaiser had dispersed much of the political base once organized by Local 2869, while the new commuter citizens had little time or focus for civic engagement. As a result, the Growth Coalition, minus a few leaders in jail or exile, handily dispersed its challengers. The Southridge-instigated recall campaign was easily defeated, while the demand for a growth moratorium was harmlessly converted into a 45-day temporary freeze on building permits. The council did scale back a few development plans in North Fontana and gave lip service to the Young report's 200 recommendations, but the most symptomatic reaction to the crisis came from Mayor Simon, then under investigation for making unlawful personal investments in one of the redevelopment areas, who simply urged Fontanans to just keep smiling. Since then, the city fathers have tried to escape bankruptcy by tacking their sails to various, sometimes countervailing winds. Like the rubes they are, they have ended up buying back into schemes virtually identical to those that Bolivianized Fontana in the early 1980s. First, they have searched high and low for some commercial deus ex machina to generate a compensatory tax flow for their fiscal deficit. Mayor Simon's own pet rock scheme, contrived during a Canadian vacation from his legal problems, was to induce a multi-billion-dollar investor to build the California version of the Edmonton Supermall in Fontana. In the absence of responses from Donald Trump or the Sultan of Brunei, the city teamed up instead with Alexander Hagen, Southern California's major mall builder, in a scheme to build a combination mall-entertainment complex in South Fontana. Just like Southridge, Hagen's Fontana Empire Center, scheduled for completion in 1995, was sold to local officials in a blaze of Orange County imagery, Fontana's answer to the South Coast Plaza. Lest any of the Fontanans stop to ponder the absurdity of a Sears-anchored mall competing with the nation's wealthiest regional center, anchored by Gucci and Neiman Marcus, Hagen anesthetized opposition by generously donating to all 10 candidates vying for the two vacant seats on the council. Recently, Hagen has started to backtrack on his original promises, proposing to develop one half of the mall site for luxury homes instead of commerce. Meanwhile, Fontana leaders have tried to scrub the city clean of its blue-collar felony flats image by drastically limiting the development of apartments and low-income units. The revised Fontana master plan even de-emphasizes starter homes, the meat and potatoes of the previous plan, to favor more expensive move-up or second homes. Salesmen of Fontana's new look, however, were immediately embarrassed by a recrudescence of the old Fontana in 1988. Millions of television viewers nationwide watched as celebrants of Martin Luther King's birthday had to be escorted down Sierra Avenue by 120 police, as acrid little knots of Fontana Klansmen shouted, "Long live the Klan, long live the white boys." Subsequent death to the Klan counter-rallies by the Jewish Defense League contributed yet more unwanted notoriety. The campaign for an upscaled Fontana also collided with plans for a reindustrialized Fontana. With an unerring sense for courting contradiction, as one group of Fontana planners was trying to increase residential exclusivity, another was simultaneously kicking out the jams for breakneck factory and warehouse construction. Offering contractors the state's fastest track for industrial development, they guarantee buildings start 6 days after application, rather than the 9 months normal elsewhere. As angry homeowners have pointed out, combining poorly monitored industrial development, much of it highly toxic, with dense residential development is like mixing oil with water. This point was vividly illustrated in 1988, when more than 1,500 Southridge residents had to be evacuated after a nearby chemical spill. The final irony, however, is Fontana's ardent courtship of Kaiser Steel's residuum, Kaiser Resources. Left with a mile-long slag mountain and 700 acres of polluted wasteland, KR, in partnership with Lusk Ontario Industries, has maneuvered brilliantly to get Fontana to foot the bill for the cleanup, by coyly flirting with Ontario and Rancho Cucamonga, then suddenly throwing kisses to advocates of independent cityhood for Fontana's unincorporated west side, Rancho Vista. KR drove Fontana officials into a jealous frenzy. As a result, debt-hobbled Fontana is offering a memorandum of understanding to KR and Lusk that would guarantee $190 million in public funds to renovate the ex-Kaiser Steel site. In particular, Fontana would help clean up the still-spreading plume of soil and groundwater contamination that is the legacy of 40 years of steelmaking, and which has replaced the smoke cloud from Kaiser's coke ovens as the symbol of environmental distress in San Bernardino County. KR and Lusk, in turn, would accept annexation by Fontana and agree to develop a high-tech industrial park. But a centerpiece of KR's plan is a perverse environmental joke, importing Silicon Valley's toxic waste for processing in Kaiser Steel's still extant treatment facility. So what's left? It's tacky, very, very tacky. But maybe I should be grateful. People tell me it used to be worse. New Fontana commuter resident. Eat shit and die. Reaction of old Fontana homeboy. After so many schemes, scandals, and sudden upheavals, what is Fontana today? Begin, arbitrarily, with its Wild West unincorporated fringe. Follow the fire engine red Kenworth K600A Anteater pulling its shackled double reefers into the lot of Trucktown off the Cherry Street exit of I-10, just south of the Kaiser Ghost plant. There are more than 120 independent trucking companies based in the Fontana area, and this is their central fuel stop and oasis. Around midnight, Trucktown really bustles and rigs are often backed up to the interstate waiting for a fuel stop or parking berth. The biggest truck stop in the country is just a few miles further west in Ontario, but drivers resent Union 76's private police force and stale pie. Cherry Avenue is clearly, as they say, west of the Pecos, and it is easier to make deals of all kinds here. Inside the cafe, the counter is occupied by an apparition of Lee's army after Appomattox, lean, bearded, hollow-eyed, and taciturn. There is more animation in the booths. Owner-operators wrestle with logbooks and second-driver problems. Husband-wife teams have family arguments. Brokers with questionable loads wrangle for haulers. Outlaw bikers peddle old ladies and black molly. Speed. The Cherry Avenue fringe has always accommodated illicit but popular activities. Until its recent closure by the Highway Patrol, the adjacent rest area on I-10 functioned as a girls and dope drive-in for morning commuters in Toyotas and tourists in Winnebagos. Now the entire Fontana periphery, including the incorporated Northside and Rialto as well as the Cherry Street area, has become the Wayaga Valley of Southern California. Long the speed capital of the world, its meth labs have recently diversified into the mass manufacture of ice, crystal smokable speed, and croak, a smokable combination of speed and crack. For the most part, this is grassroots narco-patriotism, drug addiction made in America by small-town good old boys and distributed throughout the heartland by a vast network of motorcycle gangs and outlaw truckers. From the standpoint of free enterprise economics, it is also a textbook example of small entrepreneurs filling the void left by the collapse of a dinosaur-heavy industry. Speed, not steel, is now probably Fontana's major export. Which is not to deny that a lot of steel is still being hauled out of Fontana, even if Big Bess herself was long ago melted for scrap. The multinational hybrid of California Steel Industries, just up Cherry Avenue, continues to roll Brazilian slabs into a variety of products for local markets, although the Japanese and increasingly the Koreans dominate the big-ticket structural items. The United Steelworkers recently attempted to organize CSI, but the campaign ended in disaster, whether out of fear of losing their jobs again or in resentment against the International's failure to come to their aid 8 years earlier. The ex-local 2869 men at CSI resoundingly voted the union down, 88% to 12%. The former primary steelworks itself looks like Dresden, Hiroshima, or perhaps the most fitting image, Tokyo in April 1945, after 3 months of concentrated firebombing with Kaiser-made goop, had burnt the city down to the ferro-concrete stumps of its major buildings. The wreckers long ago picked the plant clean of any salvageable metal, some of which reincarnated in Toyotas and Hyundais, zooms by on I-10. Meanwhile, the towering smokestacks, once visible for 30 miles, are collapsed into rubble, while only the skeletal concrete cores of the blast furnaces remain. Around the heavily guarded perimeter, Kaiser Resources leases land to a series of mom-and-dad scrapyards, who, having run out of Kaiser wreckage, are now happily crushing and shredding derelict automobiles. The whole scene looks like Mad Max, a post-apocalyptic society of industrial scavengers and metal vultures. Across the road lie shadows of Fontana Farms. A ghostly vintage chicken ranch is overgrown with weeds, but otherwise kept intact by its octogenarian owner, who recalls the great plague of Newcastle's disease in 1971 that killed millions of Fontana hens. A few miles away in South Fontana, a handful of chicken ranchers have managed to hang on and modernize their operations. Near the corner of Harupa and Poppers stands an astounding automatic chicken plant that works by conveyor belts, where one man can easily tend 250,000 hens. But the resulting accumulation of chicken manure is so vast that it has to be pushed around the ranch by bulldozers. Nearby commuter homeowners, no longer beguiled by the romance of chicken shit, are circulating petitions to close down this successful survival of the malarian age. When the last trace of the chickens, pigs, and orchards have been removed, Fontana's remaining link to its agrarian past will be its thousands of dogs. We are not talking about manicured suburban house dogs, but old-fashioned yard dogs, snarling half-rabid, dopey, friendly, shaggy, monstrous, and ridiculous Fontana dogs. Fontana probably has more wrecked cars per capita than anywhere else on the planet. The nearby Southern California auto auction is considered by some aficionados to be the eighth wonder of the world. More impressive to me is the vast number of dismantled or moribund cars deliberately strewn in people's yards like family heirlooms. I suppose it is a sight that blights Fontana's new image, but the junkyard sensibility can grow on you after a while. At least, it has on me. The Fontana area, or rather the parts of it that are not named Heritage or Eagle Point Executive Homes, is a landscape of randomly scattered, generally uncollectible and ungentrifiable debris, ranging from Didion's creepy boulders to the rusting smudge pots in phantom orchards to the Burma-shave-era motel names like Kentuck You Inn on Foothill Boulevard. Even crime in Fontana has a random surrealty about it. There is, for instance, the maniac who has murdered hundreds of eucalyptus trees, or Bobby Jean Style, Dr. Felden, the king of obscene phone calls, who has confessed to 50,000 dirty phone conversations over the last 23 years. Dr. Felden had perhaps wandered too far and too freely in the flesh pots of Fontana's Valley Boulevard. Still, as in 1941, Death Alley. Just east of Cherry Avenue, the boulevard is a boring repetition of adult bookstores and used truck dealerships. Closer to Sierra, however, there is a gathering sense of mise-en-scène by a down-home Fellini. On one corner, a hard-luck cowboy is trying to sell his well-worn Stetson hat to the patriarch of a family of road gypsies, or are they Okies circa 1990, who pile out of their converted Crown bus home. They have just left the Saturday swap meet at the nearby Bel Air Drive-In. Inside, a lobster-faced desert flea from Quartzsite is haggling with a trio of super bag ladies from the San Fernando Valley over the value of some Depression glass saucers and an antique commode. Some local kids with Guns N' Roses gangbang t-shirts are listening to another grizzled desert type, this one looking like Death Valley Scotty, describe his recent encounter with aliens. A Jehovah's Witness in a maroon blazer kibitzes uncomprehendingly. A block away is an even more improbable sight, a circus wrecking yard. Scattered amid the broken bumper cars and Ferris wheel seats are nostalgic bits and pieces of Southern California's famous extinct amusement parks, in the pre-Disney days when admission was free or $1. The Pike, Belmont Shores, Pacific Ocean Park, and so on. Suddenly rearing up from the back of a flatbed trailer are the fabled stone elephants and pouncing lions that once stood at the gates of Selig Zoo in Eastlake, Lincoln Park, where they had enthralled generations of Eastside kids. I try to imagine how a native of Manhattan would feel, suddenly discovering the New York Public Library's stone lions discarded in a New Jersey wrecking yard. I suppose the Selig lions might be Southern California's summary, unsentimental judgment on the value of its lost childhood. The past generations are like so much debris, to be swept away by the developers' bulldozers. In which case, it is only appropriate that they should end up here, in Fontana, the junkyard of dreams. This concludes City of Quartz by Mike Davis, narrated by Tim Campbell. Copyright 1990 by Verso. Preface 2006 by Mike Davis. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Verso Books and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.